1979. This is an interview for the Broadcast Pioneers Library with Mr. Sig Mickelson, who is currently a distinguished visiting lecturer at San Diego State University. I will begin this tape with a brief biography on Mr. Mickelson before we begin this interview. He began his broadcasting career at WCCO, an owned and operated station of CBS in Minneapolis, and worked at that station until 1949, when he moved to New York City to become Director of Public Affairs for CBS. He assumed a number of positions at CBS, including the presidency of CBS News, and left the network in 1961 to join Time Incorporated, where he was the vice president in charge of international and was concerned with television investments and operations. He left Time in 1970 and took out a few months to write his book, The Electric Mirror, and undertake some other projects. Later that year, in 1970, he moved to Chicago, where he joined the Encyclopedia Britannica Educational Corporation. He was an officer and director and responsible for the development of television productions and the development of international acquisitions and marketing. From 1972 until 1975, Mr. Mickelson was chairman of the editorial journalism department at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. In 1975, he was invited to assume the presidency of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, and that was a three-year contract. After that, he came to San Diego State to be our distinguished visiting lecturer in telecommunications and film. The interviewer on this tape is Elizabeth Heighton, Telecommunications and Film Department, San Diego State University. Mr. Mickelson, let's begin with your first job in broadcasting. How did you first get interested in a career in radio and television?
Well, I'm not exactly certain how I got interested in it. I suppose primarily through doing a lot of speech work in college, perhaps. But the first broadcasting jobs I had were in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, KSOO, and I guess the first check that I ever drew from a broadcaster was in 1934 for covering a state high school basketball tournament. I did quite a number of subsequent broadcasts and got a fairly good feel for how the whole business worked. However, after a couple of years on newspapers, I went back to graduate school, got a master's degree at the University of Minnesota, did some work toward a doctorate, and then got steered into teaching. First at LSU, Louisiana State, then at the University of Kansas. I got about 1 year ahead of the dean in each case, I guess. And finally wound up back at the University of Minnesota again. During the early part of our participation in the war, CBS, which owned WCCO, was getting quite concerned about its stations and whether they were able to cover the, or to report on the sensitive areas of international affairs and coverage of the war, unless they had adequate news staffs. WCCO at that time was operating entirely on the basis of the rip-and-read technique. They had a number of announcers reading news on a rip-and-read basis, and they also had what you might call freelance talent coming in from the outside doing it. New York, apparently, primarily Frank Stanton, who at that time was vice president for station administration, was particularly concerned and put the pressure on the WCCO management to find somebody to come in and organize a full-blown news department. Well, I was eventually tapped for it. I started out in the spring of 1943 by going in and writing a 10-minute news program daily at 11 o'clock show at night, just to get the feel for the people and the station. And while I was doing that, we were planning to actually build a newsroom and to hire a staff, so by mid-June of 1943, we were all set to go with a full-blown staff. Four people, it isn't a big one, but give us an opportunity to angle all the news locally, to do a competent news job, and to begin to go out and get some local reporting into it. It took a while to convince the people who'd been accustomed to reading the UP radio wire straight to accept the copy written for them. They couldn't understand why all this machinery was necessary, but after a year or so, they eventually got to the point where I think they were comfortable. In the meantime, we began to look more aggressively at what other things we might do, and I suppose the most significant thing that we did during that period was a series of programs on racial prejudices in the community. We discovered, surprisingly, that even in Minneapolis and St. Paul, racial prejudices were running very high. There was almost complete Jewish segregation in the community, for example. There was housing segregation, there was club segregation, even golf country club segregation. There weren't very many blacks in the community, but they were all segregated into a small section in the northern part of Minneapolis. Indians were another subject of rather serious discrimination, so we put together a series of 4 half-hour programs. This is before tape, of course, so while tape was coming in, but we didn't really know how to handle it. So these were recreations with actors and actresses and
an organ
and the like, dramatic documentaries. And we didn't realize what the smash hit this was going to be. We called it Neither Free Nor Equal. And after the series was over, we got the usual crank calls from the people who called us communists, but we began to get queries from all over the country. Well, CBS in New York was very much interested in it and encouraged the station to print up the series in rather attractive form and start widespread distribution with it. Well, the fact is we began getting more correspondence and awards for it and created quite a lot of national attention. Enough so that the next time CBS had a network documentary to do, they called on us to do it for them, so that we produced one in Minneapolis, which went out on the full network. Arrows in the dust on the Indian problem, largely in Arizona and New Mexico. Well, with this, of course, we'd achieved a national reputation. I also got involved in the Radio Television News Directors Association, called NARND, and helped found it.
When was that?
Well, that was actually begun in 1946. With about 25 or 30 people in the Allerton Hotel in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was the real originator of it was from Portland, Oregon, Portland, Maine, John Hogan. But he went in as the first president. I went in as the vice president and heir apparent to the presidency, which I had in 1948-49. Well, by this time, we'd established WCCO, I guess, as a preeminent news station. We already had the ratings, whether we did anything with a copy or not.
But how large was your staff by then?
Well, I think we had 5. I don't think it ever got beyond 5 at that period. But these were all highly competent people. Ralph Backlund is now the top editor, for example, on Smithsonian Magazine. And Ralph Andrist, who was on the staff, has been the top man in the American Heritage publications for a number of years. One of them is now the general manager of the NBC affiliate, television affiliate in the Twin Cities. Another one was a top editor at the Voice of America later on. So it was a pretty good staff from all points of view. In late 1949, I was in New York for a convention, and Dave Taylor, who was then Vice President for News and Public Affairs for the radio network, asked me if I'd come into New York as the director of one section of his department, the radio, the News and Public Affairs. It was to be what he called the Department of Talks. Well, it was more than that. It was sort of a special events department that took care of the UN and discussion shows and all that kind of thing. So I agreed to it by the middle of November 1949. A couple of weeks later, I got a call from Taylor saying, Mr. Paley would like to see you. Can you get yourself into New York in a hurry? And I had never been really convinced that there was a William S. Paley until that point. But I went on in, and what I found out was that there was a big reshuffle coming, a rather large-scale reshuffling of the whole organization. The radio organization, in effect, was absorbing the little television organization, that one single person was to be put in charge of news and public affairs for radio and television, but rather than report to top management, he was going to report to the program director for radio and television, Elba Robinson. At this point, Dave Taylor had resigned, so that I was then asked by Paley whether I would take over the whole thing, working of radio, television, news, public affairs, working under Elba Robinson.
What year was that?
That's late 49. So, well, it was much more than I'd ever anticipated. I started out going for a small job and wound up with a big one. I got there and had been there about 2 days. when I got a call from Frank Stanton around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he said, "Are you going to be around for a little while?" I said, "Yes." "Well, hold on, I'll get back to you fast." Well, I sat and sat and sat, and finally about 9 o'clock, I got the call, and I went up to his office, and he said, "Ed Chester, who's in charge of news, has just told me that if you're going to take over this whole operation, he's resigning. And we can't afford to lose him at this point because he is Spanish-speaking, has worked in Cuba and Chile for the Associated Press, and the NARBA negotiations are coming up, North American Radio Frequency Negotiations, and we've just got to have Chester involved in that, and if he resigns, we're in deep trouble. So would you be willing to step aside partway, let him have the news, and you take the public affairs?" Well, having moved to New York by this time, there wasn't much of anything I could do or say, and it's probably just as well anyway to get the slow start rather than get dumped into the whole thing. So it all wound up then with my assuming a job as Director of News and Public Affairs for Radio and Television. And that included the educational stuff we were doing, religious broadcasts, included sports, incidentally, included a lot of the longer-range special events things, including coverage of UN sessions, which we were doing then. It included the discussion shows. People's Platform was one of them, for example, Capital Cloakroom. So it was quite a big and responsible job. Well, I went on for about a year and a half, and we began to get rumblings through the corridors that another shakeup was coming. And there'd be a split of radio and television into two separate operations completely. So then people began to wonder, you know, where are we going to be positioned? Who's going to television? Who's going to radio? And if you project yourself back to 1951, you recognize that television was virtually nothing at that time. In mid-1951, there weren't more than, 8 or 9 million American homes equipped with television receivers. I think the figure was 7.2 million on January 1st, 1951.
And the freeze was in effect at that time, the FCC freeze.
The FCC freeze was in effect, and so no new stations were coming on the air. There were only the 107 or whatever it was, and many of them were not interconnected because AT&T had not yet strung up its microwave facilities. For example, the East Coast and the West Coast had no communications back and forth except by those dull, gray, scratchy old kinescopes that were being mailed back and forth across the country.
How many affiliates, television affiliates, did CBS have during those years of the freeze? Do you remember?
Well, see, I can't tell you exactly because, you see, in most communities, there were primary affiliations, secondary, and sort of ad hoc affiliations. NBC had virtually all the single-station markets all alone, and that included Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Grand Rapids, so that where CBS came in, it had to come in a secondary position, and we had to prove that we had something better than NBC in order to get into those communities at all. And one of the reasons for CBS's slow growth was the fact that it did not have the top affiliations, and it didn't dare gamble until it could pry some of those affiliations loose. But anyway, the split did come in early August, I think it was, of 1951. CBS was cut into separate divisions, a radio division, a television division. By that time, they'd acquired a manufacturing division of the engineering operation. The labs were set aside as a laboratory division, the records division, and the like. But then the two networks each had their own news and public affairs departments, so I was put in charge of news and public affairs for the television network, and Ed Chester was news and public affairs for the radio network. Well, I really didn't have much. My total news staff was 14 people.
And television at that time was the stepsister, was it not?
Stepsister, exactly. The correspondents, for example, with the big reputations, were all in the radio payroll. And we had a terrible job trying to pry one of them loose. We acquired Doug Edwards because he'd been doing the early evening news historically for a period of time.
That was the 15-minute newscast.
15 minutes, yeah, 7:30 to 7:45. Walter Cronkite came on the scene in the summer of 1950 at the outbreak of the Korean War. He was signed on as a radio reporter, with the expectation that he'd been going, that he would soon be going to Korea. But there was a change in plans, so he was left in Washington, and to find something to do, he did the 11 o'clock news on WTOP, or WOIC it was then, the Bamberger Broadcasting Corporation, Channel 9 in Washington, because we were doing the news for Channel 9 at that time. So he got projected into television simply through the fact he was doing a local show. Well, I'd known him before the war. We used to go down, and I'd go down frequently, and was rather pleased by what I saw with his work. So we eventually didn't get him on our staff, but at least we got the use of him frequently when we could pry him loose from Channel 9. So this is the metamorphosis of CBS into a radio network, a television network. The television network included the television news and public affairs. The structure was President Television Network, Jack Van Valkenburg, down to Hubble Robinson, Vice President of Programs, and I reported to Hubble Robinson as the Director of News and Public Affairs Television.
What about that nightly newscast, Douglas Edwards with the news? How was that produced, and what sort of problems did you encounter in those years?
Well, problems were absolutely enormous. In the first place, the total staff, I said 14 a little bit earlier, I think that's essentially right. There were three directors who directed all of the news. Don Hewitt was the one who did the early evening news. There were four combination writers and assignment people, mostly writers, but if they saw something happening in the New York area, they could send a camera crew out. There were four combination cameramen and film editors. All four of them, I think, had been radio technicians who had learned to operate 16-millimeter cameras as sort of home movie enthusiasts. So they moved on in and they cut the film. The film was not cut by Hollywood standards at all. It was simply a matter of cutting it with the shears and pasting it back together again. Let's see, that's four cameramen, editors, four writers, that's a total of eight. Three directors, runs you up to 11. I think there were two graphic artists, it might have been three graphic artists, who really had to work because we didn't have enough film to go around. Film was purchased from Telenews, except once in a while one of our cameramen would go out and cover a New York story. Otherwise, it all came from Telenews.
And how current was that Telenews film?
Well, it wasn't too bad, but the trouble is that what they were doing was dog and pony shows and monkey acts and fires and presidential speeches and that kind of thing, and it never was integrated into the news flow. In other words, you had correspondents, presumably, if you had them, who were doing one thing, and film was doing something else again, and it was awfully difficult to integrate the two into one solid program. Now that was one thing, one obstacle we had. Another one is that this whole 14 people were jammed into a little section on the 14th floor at 485 Madison Avenue, but the studio assigned to them was up at 58th and Park, the old Liederkranz Hall, because that's where the telecine facilities were for projection. So they had the 7:30 show to do. They finished normally cutting, splicing film, and putting a show together, writing what was necessary by 7 o'clock. And then caught a cab and went up to Liederkranz Hall. Now, during bad weather, of course, cabs in New York at that time of night are pretty scarce. And there were occasions when they had to run, carrying these film packages. From 52nd and Madison, it's two long blocks east and six shorter blocks north, plus a half a block east and down 58th Street. So this was a real obstacle and made it very difficult to do anything really useful. So there was a lot of sort of semi-professional effort to imbue some life into it, and everybody had enthusiasm. They were great from that point of view, and there was a lot of talent there, a tremendous amount of talent. So they were having a good time doing it, and always fighting the issues to make it work, and fighting all the obstacles. The equipment, of course, was entirely inferior. The old Oricon cameras delivered bad sound and bad picture. The labs, when we did use a lab, were not equipped to deliver quality. It was home movie laboratories. So what we had to do was get out from amateurism and into professionalism. And that was what we bent our efforts on for some time.
Besides the regular newscast with Douglas Edwards every evening. What sort of special broadcast did you take on?
Well, of course, in connection with the Korean War, we did a number of things. A special broadcast with State Department officials. We did a series one summer we called the Briefing Room, I guess it was, with the State Department executives in charge of various facets of State Department operations. We also did a series with the Red Cross. There was a real danger, and nobody can remember that now, in 1950, that we'd be projected into a war. Everyone was really living in fear of the possibility of getting into another war, including, I'm sure, the Pentagon and the State Department. We did a series with the Red Cross on what to do, and one of the big problems was poison ivy, for example. In that eastern country, the poison ivy is all over, and you get these New Yorkers going out into the suburbs, and we could have a real disaster. Well, that's the kind of thing that we worked on. The first big, really outsized special event that I got involved in, I came in September of 1951. John Foster Dulles, who was then a special ambassador in the State Department, had been working for several months trying to wind up the Japanese war by completing a peace treaty. And of course, in order to complete the peace treaty, they'd have to bring all of the participants in that war, some 50 of them, together in one place to go through the formality of negotiating and signing a treaty of peace. Well, they decided to do it in San Francisco in the Opera House in September 1971. And we discovered by midsummer that AT&T was making real progress toward getting its microwave relay across the country ready. And it probably would be ready for testing purposes by about that time. So we got a network committee together to go to the Long Lines Division of AT&T to see whether they'd let us use it for this event, and then withdraw it again until it was finally tested out and brought back into use very late in 1971. We eventually got permission from AT&T to use it. So then the question is, how are we going to produce the show out on the West Coast? Well, as usual then, the four networks, and I say four very carefully, ABC, CBS, Dumont, and NBC, got together in a meeting to draw who would produce the pool show. Actually, Dumont, Tom Gallery of Dumont, drew the short straw on it, so Dumont was assigned the production facility. That means that he would use KPIX as the originating station in San Francisco. CBS shared affiliation with KPIX, and Dumont just didn't have the energy or the manpower to do the job, so Gallery said, why don't you take it, which I did. So that put us in the position where we were the producing agency, using KPIX on the coast to do the producing. So we delivered the first transcontinental program on September 4th, 1971. The East had never seen a show from the West Coast up until that day. I then had to find somebody to serve as what we now call anchorman. I found my old friend Cronkite in Washington, talked to John Hayes, by then the general manager of that station, got him pried loose, so Cronkite and I went out to San Francisco and we did the peace conference.
How long was the coverage on that conference?
4 days altogether. It was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, wound up, I believe, on Friday night with the signing ceremony. So it was a four-day conference, and each night, I think, ran 3 or 4 hours. And usually started at 7 o'clock, no, wait a minute, about 5 o'clock coast time, I guess. So it was hitting Class A time, prime time in the East.
That was quite an undertaking in 51. In 1952, I know you were involved in the coverage of the political conventions.
Yeah, that, I think, is where television really made itself felt, I think. Prior to that time, it was sort of a toy, sort of a novelty. But after those political conventions were over, a lot of people who had not recognized the importance of it now saw how important it really was. We were up to about 17 million television homes by July. And, of course, the signal was going all over the whole country. We started preparing for those conventions, actually, in 1951. I went down to Washington in June 1951 to talk to the Republican National Committee chairman and His Guy Gabrielson was the chairman. Bill Mylander was the director of public relations. The reason for the trip was to convince them that if they were going to get any coverage, they would have to permit us to sell commercially. We knew that the television coverage was going to be enormously costly and much, much more than radio would ever cost. So we had a session with them then. We had several subsequent sessions and with the Democrats as well. And we finally got a commercial code set up, which would enable us to sell commercial coverage. So then the next job, of course, was to go out and sell the coverage. Well, that I was out to lunch one day, I guess in November of 1951. But when I got back to my office, I was quite surprised to see the president of the television network sitting there, along with two other men I didn't recognize. Well, it turned out to be that one was the vice president for the Consumer Products Division of Westinghouse Manufacturing. The other one was the executive vice president of the Ketchum McLeod and Grove Agency from Pittsburgh, Ed Parrott. And Van Valkenburg introduced me and said, will you tell them about your plans for the coverage of the political conventions? Well, I hurried up and created some plans and made it sound as if we'd been planning this for months and months and we knew exactly what we were going to do. And they asked questions, and questions which hadn't really been considered, but I acted as if we'd been making the plans to answer. When they left, they said, we'll talk further. Well, the upshot of that is that on Christmas night, 1951, the vice president for sales of the television network and I boarded the Pittsburgher from New York to go out to Pittsburgh, and by the next afternoon we had a deal. The first time any political event had ever been sold, and Westinghouse became the sponsor.
Was this planned as gavel-to-gavel coverage?
No, it wasn't. And the reason it got gavel-to-gavel coverage is another strange one. There are two reasons, actually. In the first place, the AT&T facilities, whereas they extended across the country, had only single lines going into many sections. There was a single line, for example, south from Washington down to Atlanta and from Atlanta into Florida, and it branched off from there with a single line going over to New Orleans. There was a single line from Chicago down to St. Louis, from St. Louis down the Mississippi into Texas and doubling back up into Oklahoma again. And we couldn't figure out any way to divide up those facilities in any reasonable basis. The other problem was that there were all those single station markets at that point. The freeze had only been lifted in May 1972, and the stations had not yet come on the market. Those that were licensed between May and July had no time to get their facilities in order, so that there were a great number of single station markets. And the question is, who's going to get at them? And how are four networks going to divide all this business up? So we finally decided the only way we could possibly arrive at an equitable solution to the division problem would be to go gavel to gavel. And we determine each day the definition of gavel to gavel. And then we divided up the sessions, so each network would get its time. For example, on the first day, we drew straws for the first session, second session, the third session the next day, and kept on rotating so that the the person who had the first session would get the full network for that session, then it would switch to the second session. Dumont, in the meantime, just didn't have the strength to compete, and we badly needed their facilities. We had no outlet in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh was the home of Westinghouse. So we made a deal with Dumont to give service to their Washington station, their New York station, and of course we got the Pittsburgh station that way. So that in effect, I guess you might say, we bought Dumont out of it. But it was costly because that put a competition in against our own CBS-owned station, Channel 2 in New York, with their own signal. One ironic aspect of that, one of the television critics wrote a column of effusive praise for Dumont, saying that the others are way behind. Clearly the outstanding leader in the whole field is Dumont. Their coverage of the political conventions was superb. Well, that's criticism.
I know the public was fascinated to be able to see political conventions firsthand. Would you comment on how the delegates and the candidates responded to having television